You're listening to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast, where we teach you everything you need to know about adopting a plant-based diet, full or part-time. Our goal is to empower you to live a long and healthy life. You can find today's show at ordinaryvegan.net or on iTunes. If you have any questions, please send an email to questions@ordinaryvegan.net.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast, number 23. If you're new to this podcast, my name is Nancy Montori, and I advocate a plant-based diet for optimum health. And what is best for your health also happens to be best for the planet. Not only that, a plant-based diet extends kindness to animals. What more could we ask for? Thank you all for being here today. I appreciate your emails, kind words, reviews on iTunes, and all your support. It is what keeps me going. Today is very exciting because we are welcoming one of the leading physicians in the plant-based world to this podcast. His name is Dr. Neil Barnard. And he is a tireless champion for a low-fat, plant-based diet and its ability to prevent and even reverse chronic disease. His multitude of accomplishments include being president and founder of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, also known as PCRM. The PCRM is leading a revolution in medicine by advocating nutrition as medicine and higher ethical standards in nutrition research. Dr. Barnard has a medical degree and is an associate professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences in Washington, D.C. He has led numerous research studies investigating the effects of diet on diabetes, body weight, and chronic pain, including a groundbreaking study of dietary interventions in type 2 diabetes. And in his free time, he writes best-selling books like Power Foods for the Brain, 21-Day Weight Loss Kickstart, and Dr. Neil Barnard's program in reversing diabetes, to name just a few. There will be links to all of Dr. Barnard's groundbreaking books in this week's show notes. Oh, and check this out. Dr. Barnard is also a talented guitarist and music composer and released a music video this year from his band Carbon Works called Samurai. As many of you know, my former career was 23 years at Warner Brothers Records, and I must admit, I was very impressed by Dr. Barnard's music. Today, we are going to discuss his latest book called The Cheese Trap, How Breaking a Surprising Addiction Will Help You Lose Weight, Gain Energy, and Get Healthy. This book provides a cutting-edge program to help readers adopt a new set of habits pertaining to cheese to lose weight, gain energy, and get healthy. So let's get to it and learn everything we need to know to help kick the cheese habit. Hello, everybody. I am very excited to welcome Dr. Neil Barnard to our podcast today. Hi, Dr. Barnard.
Hi, thank you for including me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And before we get to the main topic of cheese, I wanted to ask you, Dr. Barnard, is when you had your last piece of cheese and why did you go plant-based?
My last piece of cheese, I would have to say probably 1984. And why did I do this? It was a logical extension of a whole series of events that began in the basement of Fairview Hospital in Minneapolis. I was the morgue attendant, sometimes referred to as the autopsy assistant, meaning when somebody died in the hospital, I helped the pathologist examine the body and determine the cause of death. And you learn a lot when you see what goes on behind the ribs of a dead person. One day we had a person who died in the hospital of a massive heart attack, and probably from eating hospital food, but that's another story. And the pathologist removed a section of ribs from the front of the chest, and that exposed the heart, and he showed me what atherosclerosis really looks like, and we talked about what causes it. And at the end of the exam, he finished up, and he wrote up all his notes, and he left. And so I had to clean up, and I put the ribs back in the chest and sewed up the skin and cleaned everything up, and I went up to the cafeteria, and they were serving ribs for lunch. And I have to tell you, it smelled like a dead body, and it looked like a dead body, and it suddenly hit me that it was a dead body. And I didn't become a vegetarian on the spot, but I couldn't eat it. And as time went on, I started to understand the links between what we put in our mouths and the health that we have. And from there, it goes to the environmental part and the animal concerns about the welfare of the animals. And all of these things are motivators. And so it took me some time to make the transition, going from omnivore to ovo-lacto-vegetarian to vegan. And to me, going to a vegan diet is not extreme in any way. It's sometimes people imagine, oh my goodness, you know, is that the end extreme end diet? To me, it's the beginning. It's super easy to eat spaghetti with tomato sauce and bean burritos and veggie chili. I mean, vegan diet is easy and filled with wonderful taste. But once I was getting the animal products off my plate, which is a great move, then you can explore lots of other things. There's so many different ways of doing this, from a Mediterranean type of vegan diet to a Latin American to an Asian pattern, many different tastes. How much should be raw? How important is it to be sort of in a macrobiotic pattern? Or, you know, there are just so many ways to explore it and refine it and perfect it. And so it's been a continuing journey for me. And I guess I'm still exploring today, but I haven't had any animal products since the 1980s.
Wow, congratulations. Well, the timing of this podcast is perfect because I recently did a survey with the Ordinary Vegan Health and Wellness community to uncover their major hurdles to a plant-based diet. And the number one hurdle continues to be their love of cheese. They can't let go of cheese. So let's break it down. How much cheese do people actually consume?
You know, despite the fact that it smells like old socks, the average American eats 35 pounds of it every single year. That works out to be about 65,000 calories worth of cheese every year. And that's a new number. It has been gradually going up and up and up ever since the USDA started tracking what Americans eat back early in the 20th century. So we have hit 35 pounds per person per year.
Wow. Is there a certain demographic that consumes the most cheese?
That's a great question. And I don't think I know the answer to that. I would be tempted to say that it's inversely with age, meaning that children eat proportionately more than their parents. Of course, their body size is smaller, so their portion size are smaller, but proportionately, each generation seems to take on more than the others, and partly that's because it's being pushed on them by schools. They go into the school, and the schools, of course, have dairy dumped on them by the federal government that uses schools as a dumping ground for unsold commodities. So they prop up farm income by buying up cheese. The government does buys it up, and it dumps it in schools, and kids eat it. And then, of course, busy parents buy cheese pizza for their kids and leave it in the fridge, and that would be my guess.
Does cheese cause weight gain?
I think it does, yeah. If you add cheese to your diet, well, let's put it this way. A burger is completely unhealthy. Nobody should have it anyway. However, let's say you add a slice of cheese to your burger. It's not as if you're going to eat less of the burger. It just adds unnecessary calories. But more than that, the cheese is 70% fat, and fat grams are a real problem because, first of all, a gram of fat has 9 calories, unlike, say, carbohydrate or even pure sugar, which has only 4. So the fat grams are more than double the calories, and if cheese is 70% fat, you're getting a ton of calories in a small space. But also, the fat grams don't need to be modified in any way in order to add to your body fat. So it can go straight to your body fat. It doesn't ramp up your metabolism or anything. And then finally, the cheese making process uses a lot of salt. The salt is there to add taste, but also to keep the fermentation process in check. And so a huge amount of salt, there is more salt ounce per ounce in cheese than there is in potato chips. And the salt adds water weight. So people gain weight, mostly fat, but also water weight from eating cheese.
So what does fat actually do to your body?
Well, the fat that you eat does add to body fat. That's the first thing. So it increases body weight. Secondly, if it's saturated fat, which is the bad fat that predominates in cheese and other dairy products, and also in meat, the saturated fat does a lot of bad stuff. It raises your cholesterol, and over the long run is going to make it more likely that you will have a heart attack or a stroke. It gets inside your muscle cells and liver cells and increases the risk of developing diabetes. So those are enough. It basically increased risk of obesity, heart disease, diabetes, as well as some other problems.
And you mentioned once in one of your lectures that fat interferes with calorie burning. Can you explain how it does that?
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. You bring people into the lab, and as an experiment, you increase the fat content of their diet. And by Wednesday or Thursday of that week, their calorie burning speed will be slowed down. And when that was discovered, as time has gone on, we've figured out what's happening. The fat gets into the muscle cells. The muscle cells have mitochondria in them. Mitochondria are these tiny little, we call them organelles. It's a tiny little microscopic organ inside the muscle cell. And the mitochondria are calorie burners. And when you're eating more fat, the fat gets inside the muscle cells, the mitochondria, if they eat up all the fat, if they metabolize all the fat, then it's all used up. And so the body has a mechanism for preserving the fat as a future energy source. And it does that by reducing the mitochondria, reducing production of them or reducing their activity. And so what this means is the more fatty foods you eat and the more the fat gets into your cells, your body reduces its metabolism to preserve that fat. At least that's what we believe is going on. And you can measure this very quickly. As I said, you know, within 3, 4, 5 days, the metabolism is noticeably slowed down. And for many people, they say, gee, you know, I'm 46 now. When I was 16, I could eat anything. But now I just look at food and I gain weight. It seems like my metabolism is slow. It's not your imagination. It's really true. So what we believe is if we get the fat out of our diet, that's not so likely to happen.
I talk a lot about fiber on this podcast. And does cheese have fiber? And why does that matter?
Well, it does matter. And fiber is plant roughage. And since Velveeta is not a plant, it doesn't have any fiber at all. And there's no fiber in meat. There's no fiber in any dairy product, no fiber in eggs. And the reason this is important, well, there's several reasons. The one that everybody's aware of is that fiber is sort of like a broom for your digestive tract. It helps sweep things away and it keeps you from being constipated and so forth. That's good. Another really important thing is that fiber doesn't have calories or effectively no calories. So if I follow a plant-based diet and everything I eat is either from a vegetable or a fruit or a grain or a bean, then I'm getting fiber. And the fiber fills you up, but since it doesn't have calories to speak of, you push away from the table sooner. If you're eating cheese, or for that matter, meat or eggs, they have no fiber, so every calorie that's in them, you get. And we believe this is part of the reason why people following a plant-based diet are skinnier. They have a substantially healthier body weight on average compared to meat eaters or even ovo-lacto vegetarians.
Well, while we're on that subject, can you share the Adventist health study that had over 60,000 participants?
Yeah, this was, it's been published a number of times, but the data that really grabbed me were published by the American Diabetes Association in 2009. And the reason they studied Adventists was that by church teachings, the Adventist community is supposed to avoid alcohol and tobacco and caffeine, which they do for the most part. But they're also supposed to avoid meat, and some of them do that and some ignore that guidance. And that actually sets up a perfect natural study where you've got health conscious non-smokers who follow different kind of diets. And the results are amazing. The meat eaters, on average, tend to be overweight, just like your average American is overweight. Two-thirds of Americans are not happy with their weight. But then if you look at what they call semi-vegetarian, these are people who eat meat but less than once a week. They're a little bit thinner, although not dramatically so. Then pesco-vegetarians who eat fish but no other meat, they're a little slimmer. The ovo-lacto-vegetarians, a little bit skinnier. These are people who consume dairy and milk, but and eggs rather, but no meat at all. They're slimmer than the people who eat meat. But the vegan group, people who eat no animal products at all, are clearly the slimmest on average. And they are, in fact, the only group that on average is in the healthy weight range. And so what we believe is going on is, number one, they're not eating any animal fat, so they're not getting those calories. Plus, every mouthful has fiber, and so it fills them up a little bit sooner.
Wow. I should really know this, but I honestly don't. What is cheese, anyways? How do they make cheese?
Cheese is obviously made from milk. So early in the morning, the milk truck arrives and pours the milk into what looks like a wading pool. And bacteria are added to ferment the lactose sugar that's there. And when you think about what bacteria they are going to choose, it's an interesting thing. But between your toes, there are bacteria called Brevibacteria, B-R-E-V-I, Brevibacteria. And if you happen to have a college roommate who didn't do his or her laundry for an extra long time, didn't wash his feet, didn't shower, that increasingly rank odor is caused in part by the Brevibacteria that are growing and fermenting the dead skin between his toes and so forth. Well, if you're making Munster or Limburger or some of these other cheeses, you're not using something like Brevibacteria. You're using the genus Brevibacteria. And that's why they smell like stinky feet, because it's basically what it is. So if people still have an appetite for going on, that's how it starts. You add the bacterial cultures to the milk. That causes the fermentation process to crank out all the stinky flavors. And then you add rennet to coagulate the solids. And the rennet is an enzyme that comes from the fourth stomach of a slaughtered calf. Wow. It's an enzyme that coagulates the solids. But most dairies, most cheese plants no longer use that. They use genetically engineered rennet. And then you drain out all the liquid that's remaining, and you're left with this solid chunk of stuff. And you put a lot of salt all over the top to stop the fermentation process from going too far. And that's cheese.
Wow. And that's the reason it has so much sodium, huh?
Yeah, oh, exactly. There is sodium in milk anyway, but they add a lot in the cheese making process. And to give you some numbers, if I have 2 ounces of potato chips, they have 330 milligrams of sodium. So that's a lot. You know, anybody who's got high blood pressure, they're going to worry, don't have too many potato chips. But if you have exactly the same size serving, 2 ounces of, say, cheddar, it's got 350 milligrams of sodium. And if it's Edam, it's about 500. And if it's Velveeta, it's about 800 milligrams of sodium in a typical 2 ounce serving. So it's a lot.
Well, is goat cheese healthy since it doesn't have cow's milk?
No. If anything, it's worse. People don't buy goat milk because they think it's healthier. They buy goat milk because it sounds romantic to them. Okay, we're going to go over the hillside, and there's this cute little farm where they keep goats. And I know the farmer. It sounds small and personal, and so that's the idea. It's not that it's going to help you. And in fact, if you look at the fat that's in it, the quantity that is saturated, the proportion of the fat that's bad fat, saturated fat, is slightly higher in the goat milk or the sheep milk compared to cow's milk. We haven't talked about this yet, but hopefully we will. All animal milks come from an animal who has been impregnated and has given birth. And they are impregnated every year, typically, and this is true for goats, it's also true for cows, they're pregnant, a cow's pregnancy is about 9 months. So for 3/4 of the year, they're pregnant. A pregnant animal makes hormones. The hormones get into the milk. You're drinking that. And it's not much, it's just traces. But when you turn it into cheese, those traces are concentrated more. It's still not a lot, but we do have evidence that it does affect human biology. At least that's what that's what the studies seem to suggest. And it's true for a goat. It's true for any animal that you have decided to milk.
In your book, The Cheese Trap, you really unveil why people get hooked on cheese. Can we talk about that?
Sure.
That cheese is an actual addiction, and I think that you even called it dairy crack.
Milk has opiates in it. These are narcotic compounds that are in the protein, and they're not added by a pharmacy. The cow makes them, and you could look at the casein protein that's in milk, if you look at it with a powerful microscope, it would look like a string of beads, and each bead is an amino acid. And during digestion, they are all broken apart, and those amino acids get into your bloodstream. But in and amongst them are little strings of amino acids, maybe 4, 5, 6, 7 amino acids in length, and you absorb them, and they go to your brain, and they attach to the same receptors that heroin or morphine or Demerol or any other narcotic would attach to. And so they have a narcotic effect. It's not terribly strong. The strongest one is called morphiseptin. It has about 1/10 the brain binding power compared with pure morphine. So it's not zero, but it's not enough to get you arrested. But it is enough for you to say, gee, I don't think I could give up cheese. I feel hooked on it. I hope we have some left for tomorrow. And I think cheese is addicting.
Is cheese addiction as potent as, say, drug or alcohol addiction?
I'm going to say no. However, it's a different kind of thing. I think it's much easier to get away from really any food than it is, say, for something like tobacco. And I say this as a person who has made both of those shifts in my own life. But at the same time, people do feel hooked on it, and the problem that we have is that tobacco is now frowned on. It's easier to quit now than it ever was because you can't smoke at work, you can't smoke in a restaurant, you can't smoke in a hospital, you can't smoke in all these places, and so the world is really pushing you to quit. On the other hand, the world is pushing unhealthy foods on you, particularly cheese, everywhere you turn, and so that's what makes this particular addiction harder to break.
Yes, if you go on the internet, you will find numerous articles from reputable magazines like Fitness Magazine and Eating Well and Huffington Post, and they say that cheese is healthy because of the vitamin D and protein. So there's no wonder people get confused. So why the disconnect? I mean, it's certainly understandable why people think cheese is healthy. What can you say to them we'll get to the chronic disease part soon, but I mean, why the disconnect?
The disconnect is you have people selling it, and people sell you things, and they distort the truth in order to shake the money out of your pockets. There is calcium in cheese. There's calcium in milk, and it gets into the cheese. However, there's calcium in asphalt. This doesn't mean that it's a healthy food. And here's what I mean by that. The cow does not make calcium. Let me repeat that. The cow doesn't make calcium at all. The cow eats calcium. Where is calcium? It's in the ground. And so the roots of a plant pull the calcium into the plant. So if you eat a green leafy vegetable like broccoli or kale or collard greens or Brussels sprouts, you get the calcium that the plant has. Cows eat green leafy vegetables too. They're called grass. And as the cow eats the grass, the cow gets calcium, so it goes into the cow's body. Now, you are a primate. You're not a carnivore, so your natural source of calcium is green leafy vegetables or other plants. And a cow is an herbivore, too, and so the cow gets it. And if you decide, I'm going to get my calcium from the cow's milk, well, you can, but there's a couple things wrong with that. First of all, it's much less absorbable than the calcium in green leafy vegetables, and the numbers are For cow's milk, it's about 32% absorbable. The calcium is, the other 68% never gets past your digestive tract wall. It goes out with the feces right into the toilet. For green leafy vegetables, it's well over 50% for most of them. Secondly, if you drink cow's milk or have cheese, you get a lot of cholesterol and fat and sodium with it. If you get your calcium from green leafy vegetables, you get beta carotene and iron and healthy things that your body can actually use along with it. So no, cheese is not healthy, and people consume it for entertainment purposes, not because there's anything good in it.
Does the cheese industry know that cheese is really addictive, and do they optimize that in some way?
Oh, for sure. They've done a lot of the research on it. They are very eager to maximize these addictions. In fact, for quite a number of years now, the dairy industry has been working specifically with the U.S. government to promote cheese addiction. I know that sounds strong. Back in the year 2000, there was an event called the Cheese Forum. And we learned about this through the Freedom of Information Act. We have all the slides that were presented. And it's really interesting. The government worked with the Dairy Management Inc. to put on this program where they talked about some people being sort of food addicted, and you could trigger their cheese craving by making sure the cheese was in front of them. And what the government ended up doing was signing contracts with fast food chains to emphasize cheese more and more and more, and put it in the signage and put it in a little hat that says, "Ah, the power of cheese," and just make sure that people couldn't escape it. They worked with Wendy's to market the Cheddar Lovers Bacon Cheeseburger. This was a U.S. government program that sold 2.25 million pounds of cheese. And if people are thinking, why the heck would the U.S. government want to do this? It's because it has to do it. Congress had the bad judgment to pass a law that said that the U.S. government must promote American agricultural products. And the dairy industry has been very aggressive about sitting at the front of the class and saying, "I want you to support us more than anybody else." And so the government has done this. So by law, they got to promote things, and they promote cheese.
Wow. Okay, let's talk about the health problems associated with cheese. And let's really break it down. Does cheese play a role in cancer?
I think where we'd be on our strongest footing would probably be with hormone-related cancers, specifically prostate cancer. The last word has not been written on this, but it started out with just observations between different countries, where the dairy-consuming countries had a lot more prostate cancer, and the countries like Japan, say, that didn't have dairy industries historically, they had very little prostate cancer. And then the next observation was, if you grew up in a place like Japan but you moved to the United States, your cancer risk went up. So it wasn't being Japanese, it wasn't something genetic, it was something about the environment, and it had to do with food. And then researchers at Harvard took it a step further. They said, okay, we're going to take 21,000 American doctors, and they're all healthy, nobody's got cancer, but we're going to track their diet. And it turned out that the men who consumed the most dairy products had substantially higher prostate cancer risk. And then they did it again with a larger group of people, more than twice the size, called the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study, found exactly the same thing. And the increased risk is not trivial. It was on the order of between 30 and 60%. And the reason I emphasize that is prostate cancer is already common. And if you make it 30% more common, or 40 or 50 or 60% more common, you're talking about a lot of dead bodies. And that's where we are with it now. So I think there is a need for continuing research in this area, but we are long past the point where we should be stopping recommending dairy products at all. And cheese is the worst of it, really.
So if anyone suffered from prostate cancer or worry about prostate cancer, would you recommend that they take cheese or cow's milk out of their diet completely?
Oh, yes. Yes, sure. And in fact, Dean Ornish did a wonderful investigation where, you know, Dean Ornish, of course, is very famous for reversing heart disease, an extremely innovative researcher. And along the line, it became clear that the kind of diet that he had been promoting for reopening the narrowed coronary arteries, that diet looked like it ought to help cancer patients. So he did a study of men. They all had prostate cancer, and he used a vegan diet, meaning no animal products, and followed these men for over a year. And the control group that got no dietary intervention continued to worsen. When I say worsen, the blood test that you follow for prostate cancer is called prostate-specific antigen, or PSA, and it gradually worsens in cancer patients, and that's what happened to the control group. But the experimental group that went on a vegan diet did better and better and better, and on average, their PSA was not worsening. In fact, it improved. It dropped over a year. Now, I hasten to say that I am not suggesting that cancer patients cancel their doctor's appointment and no longer have any other treatments or anything like that. I mean, that's a discussion they need to have with their own doctors. But you're going to eat breakfast, and you're going to eat lunch, and you're going to eat dinner. Why not have it be healthy? And healthy means get rid of the junk, which is the animal products, the greasy, oily stuff, the added sugar and whatnot. And it means adding the healthy things, which are vegetables and fruits and beans and whole grains. And I would add a B12 supplement to that, and maybe a vitamin D supplement if you're not getting any sun.
Oh, what role does cheese play in heart disease?
Well, when people have known for a very long time that bad fat, saturated fat, increases cholesterol levels. And the cholesterol that's in foods adds a little bit more to your cholesterol level too. Well, cheese has the mother load of both of these. Dairy products are the biggest source of bad fat in the diet, bigger than meat. And they're also abundant with cholesterol, and that's because there's cholesterol in milk, but it's concentrated when you turn the milk into cheese. Cheese is also extremely high in sodium, as we've been talking about earlier. What does that do? Raises your blood pressure. What does blood pressure do to your heart? It aggravates the damage of a bad diet. So if you wanted to really hammer your heart, there's almost no more effective way to do that than with animal products that provide the fat and the cholesterol, and they have none of the fiber that you need. And dairy is part of that assault.
In one of your lectures, you mentioned a study called the Chicago Health and Aging Project and the role that animal protein played in Alzheimer's. And that's a really big concern for so many people. So can we break that down?
Sure. Yeah, although it wasn't the protein, it was the fat. And I hasten to mention that because sometimes people use the word protein to mean meat. And meat is not protein. Meat is muscle tissue that came out of an animal. And there is protein in it, and there's fat in it, and there's the occasional parasite. But protein is a nutrient that's in a lot of foods. So in the Chicago Health and Aging Project, what they did is, beginning in 1993, they started following a large group of people in Chicago, and they tracked what they ate, and they tracked who stayed mentally clear and who did not. And it was amazing. And in 2003, they reported some really very, very important findings, which were that the men or men and women who consumed the most saturated fat, that's the fat we've been talking about, the fat that's solid at room temperature, like bacon grease or cheese fat, dairy fat, the people who ate the most saturated fat had two or three times the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease compared with people who ate less saturated fat. And to get into that high-risk group was very easy. If you had just a couple eggs, a glass of milk, cheese pizza, you know, some chicken, it's really easy to get up to the amount of saturated fat that puts you at high risk. And that really explains something, which is Americans are at high risk of Alzheimer's disease, and that risk seems to be increasing, and it's not just because we have more older people. There's something going on, and what we believe now is that if we make diet changes, and particularly make them early in life, we think that we can prevent some of the cases of Alzheimer's disease.
Wow. Does cheese play a role in diabetes?
Yes. Earlier I was talking about how fat gets into the muscle cells. And it gets into the liver cells as well. And I talked about how it interferes with mitochondrial function and slows down your metabolism, but it does something else. You have that cheese sandwich, and the cheddar cheese or mozzarella, it's 70% fat. The fat goes into your bloodstream, gets into the muscle cells. And when it does that, it interferes with insulin's ability to work. Insulin is the hormone that acts like a key to let sugar get into the cells. And when the fat gets into the muscle cells, the insulin no longer works very well. And so the first step of type 2 diabetes is insulin resistance, and we now believe that it is caused by the buildup of fat inside these cells. And the reason that we know that is researchers, and let me say a particular word of praise for Yale University researchers, Jerry Shulman and Kit Peterson and their team, where they do MR spectroscopy. And it's amazing. You can look in a person's body non-invasively. You're looking inside their cells. You see the buildup of fat. And this could be an 18-year-old healthy person. But if you see this huge buildup of fat, you know that person is headed for insulin resistance and ultimately to type 2 diabetes unless things change. And the reason this is so incredibly important is you ask your average person what causes diabetes. They say, diabetes, that means you got too much sugar in your blood, so it must be caused by eating sugar. And they are oblivious to the fact that it came from the buildup of fat.
How about the role dairy products play in diseases like asthma, rheumatoid arthritis?
Yeah, when I was writing The Cheese Trap, I actually included the story of a young man who grew up in New Hampshire, right on the water, and he was very athletic. A guy, his name was Chad, liked playing ball games and so forth, except he couldn't get through a game because he had asthma, and exercise triggers asthma attacks, and he might end up in the emergency room, or he would go to a friend's house and they'd have a dog, and the dog allergies would trigger his asthma. So every day it was just medications and so forth, trying to get through life. When he was 18, somebody mentioned to him that dairy products affect your respiratory health. So he went completely vegan. He threw out all the dairy and all the animal products altogether. Within about 3 months, not only was his asthma gone, but all of his allergies were gone. And I described Chad's story in The Cheese Trap because I want other people to give this a try. I've heard from so many people where their asthma went away when they got away from dairy. I don't believe it's going to cure everybody, but I think it's going to help a lot of people. And another curious observation is, although some people are allergic to cow's milk, it's not a lot of people. But it does seem like for many people, consuming dairy products makes other allergies worse. And I don't know why that is. But when you see a person on a meaty diet, a dairy-filled diet, and they're allergic to a cat, they can't pet a cat without getting itchy eyes or whatever. Their seasonal allergies are killing them, they got asthma. You get that person away from animal products, and for some reason, their allergies start to get better. They don't respond so badly to cats and to seasonal allergies and so forth. Again, it doesn't cure everybody, but it helps a lot of people. So if anybody listening to this program has trouble with allergies, just get away from the animal products and see if your allergies don't improve.
And how about rheumatoid arthritis? That seems to be, a big problem.
Yeah, it certainly is. If you could look into the joints of a person with rheumatoid arthritis, the joints are inflamed, they're ugly looking. What's happening is that antibodies are attacking the synovial lining, the lining of the joint, it's called the synovium. These antibodies are like torpedoes that are there to attack bacteria and to attack viruses, but for some reason they're attacking you. They're attacking your own body tissues. Something has triggered the formation of these, and that something is a protein. It's a protein, probably something you ate, and the one that we have been zeroing in on especially is dairy protein. What I mean by that is that when people have autoimmune conditions, rheumatoid arthritis is one, there are others, when they get away from cow's milk, they very often do better. Sometimes they go away. And the worst of the lot is, rheumatoid arthritis is a bad one. And if you have rheumatoid arthritis, run, don't walk to a vegan diet. It won't cure everybody, but it does help a lot of people, and sometimes they are cured. But the one that I am most worried about is type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune reaction where antibodies forming in the body to some protein trigger, the antibodies then destroy the insulin-producing cells of the pancreas. you got to stop that attack from happening. And what we believe is, what the evidence suggests, is that at least for some of these kids, the dairy protein is the trigger. Now, that starts to make sense when you realize a child should be breastfeeding from his mother or her mother, not from a cow. And the cow protein is something that Mother Nature never intended to enter the human body. And so some kids develop a reaction to it.
There's a lot of confusion surrounding soy in women's hormones. But don't dairy products affect women's hormones?
They seem to. Let me come back to what you said about soy. The mythology is like this. You go on the internet and you read an article somewhere that said soy has some kind of hormones in it that could cause breast cancer, or if you had breast cancer already, they could make it grow faster. That's the urban myth. The truth is that soy contains what are called isoflavones. And the isoflavones, with names like genistein, for example, they have a chemical structure that looks vaguely like hormones. And yet when women consume more soy products, such as soy milk or tofu or tempeh or others, turns out that their breast cancer risk doesn't go up. It actually goes down. And that may be especially true for the soy that they consumed early in life, if they were big soy milk drinkers as children. And when you put all the studies together, there are quite a number of studies that go in this direction. They're very consistent. The improvement in breast cancer risk is about 30% for the women who consume the most soy. Secondly, women who have had breast cancer in the past, if they consume soy products, their risk of a cancer recurrence will go down as well. The likelihood of dying of your breast cancer is cut by about 30% amongst the group consuming the most soy compared to the group consuming the least. And that's really important because some women have been counseled by their well-meaning but ill-informed oncologists to avoid soy because the oncologist says, I read in a magazine somewhere that soy is bad for women with cancer. And the patient says, excuse me, you're an oncologist. Why are you giving me some nonsense you read in a magazine? And the doctor says, no, I think this might be true. I read it on the internet too. It's just nonsense. If you read the studies, they are exactly the opposite. It's really quite clear. Soy does not cause cancer to form, and it doesn't cause it to accelerate and so forth. I'm not promoting soy. You don't have to have it, but it does not cause cancer.
I thank you so much for clearing that up because I get a lot of pushback when I mention that on my podcast or in my blog posts that, you know, that it is a myth.
Yeah, well, it is. And if people have some doubts about this or if they want the references, please go to the Cheese Trap. You will see it written down in black and white with the references are listed. You can look it up yourself. The evidence is really quite convincing. But for some reason, this is a myth that won't die. And let me say, this: a plant-based diet is not the soybean cheerleading club. You can avoid soy, except that soy is very convenient. And the things it replaces, if you have soy milk, it's way better than cow's milk. If you have a soy burger or soy sausage, that is so much better than sausage that came out of a pig. So it's convenient and it's a good way to go, but you don't have to have it. I mean, if you're having vegetables and fruits and beans and grains, soy is totally optional. But how about if we come back to the question about hormones in milk, though?
Yes.
As I mentioned earlier, to force the cow to produce milk, the farmer impregnates the cow. This is done through artificial insemination. The cow is not having a good time with it. But the cow's not going to object because she's chained by the neck and she can't fight it. So she is impregnated every year, and her pregnancy is roughly 9 months, similar to a human. And what that means is that 3/4 of every year she's pregnant. Pregnant cows make estrogens. The estrogens go into the blood. From there, they go into the milk, and it's only traces. However, in Rochester, New York, researchers studied men. And they did sperm counts in the men, and they looked at sperm morphology and motility. In other words, were the sperm the normal shape, and did they move normally? And what they found was really intriguing. The men who ate the most cheese, specifically cheese, had lower sperm counts, worse morphology and worse motility of sperm as well compared to the men who avoided cheese. So something about the cheese was goofing up their fertility. And this raised the question, could it be those traces of hormones in the milk that got into the cheese? Well, hold that thought, because researchers in California then looked at women, and specifically they looked at women who had been diagnosed with breast cancer and treated. So they all had been successfully treated. What is on their mind is my cancer ever going to come back? And could my cancer kill me? Turned out that the women who consumed one or more servings of high-fat dairy every day, that's butter or cheese, or whole milk perhaps, the women who consumed one or more servings of high-fat dairy had a 49% increased risk of dying of their cancer compared to the women who had less than half a serving a day. So the women in California, the men in Rochester, and some other research studies as well, have left researchers really scratching their heads, because we had thought that, sure, the cows are pregnant, but the traces of estrogen that get in the milk is not very much. But the question we're now asking is, we do know that the hormones are in the fat goes into the cheese, it's concentrated in the cheese, and we know that your average American adult that consumes 35 pounds of this every year, is that it may be enough to affect the delicate biology of human reproduction? And our answer is maybe, yeah, it is. So while the scientists are working this out, I strongly suggest that if you have a six-year-old daughter or a seven-year-old son or a husband or wife you care about, throw that cheese away.
Wow. I remember you mentioning migraines and the connection with, I believe it was with cheese. So can you explain that?
Yes. People with migraines, and by the way, migraine is not a stress headache. Migraine is like a sledgehammer that just whacks you in the side of the head and it keeps hitting you. It pulses. It's miserable. But people who have had migraines know that food can be a trigger. For many of them, alcohol is a trigger, and sometimes cheese is a trigger. But what they may not realize is that their migraines can improve or go away when they make some pretty big diet changes. And so I encourage people not to just get away from the aged cheeses, which is what their neurologist might have told them, but to get away from all of them. In fact, get away from skim milk. I have a good friend who really loves milk, and she loves yogurt, and whenever she has them, she gets a migraine. And a year goes by, she hasn't had any milk, she's been migraine-free, and then she thinks, maybe I'm cured, and she'll have some, and the migraines come back. And, you know, it's a wonderful sense of power to be able to have these go away. So we don't know for sure, but what we believe it is we think it's the protein that is the trigger, not the fat, not the sugar, not the hormones in the case of migraine.
So is there any ailment or disease that I didn't cover, that I didn't ask you about, that people should be aware of?
Well, we were talking about the hormones earlier, and in the cheese trap, I wanted to share the experience of Catherine Lawrence, who was an aerospace engineer for the Air Force. She was in Iraq starting in 2003, and when you're in a war zone, you eat what the government gives you, you don't get any weight, but she finished her tour of duty, she went back home, and she started eating in abundance all the things she had not had in Iraq, particularly cheese, and tucked into it and gained weight. And she had a particular thing for macaroni and cheese. A friend of hers knew she loved those macaroni and cheese dinners and gave her an entire case of them, which Catherine dutifully ate 48 days straight, macaroni and cheese. So anyway, she gained weight, but she developed this condition called endometriosis, which is a painful condition that goes with a woman's monthly cycle. It's caused by cells that are in the uterus migrating out of the uterus, and they implant in the abdomen, and they cause pain. They can lead to infertility. And that was her situation. This pain was agonizing. Nothing would make it go away. And to make a long story short, her doctor said, you got to have a hysterectomy. They basically just remove all the organs, and your pain's going to hopefully go away. And she didn't want to do that because she was hoping to have a family, and yet there was no solution. So they scheduled the hysterectomy. However, before she had the procedure, a friend encouraged her to do a vegan diet, no dairy at all, no animal products. And she thought, what have I got to lose? And she did it. And almost immediately she felt better. Her weight came down and her pain started to diminish. And eventually she went back to the gynecologist who did a laparoscopy where you look into the abdomen through a little scope. And the surgeon closed her up and sent her to the recovery room and went out to the waiting room and said to her husband, this is really remarkable. Her endometriosis is just about gone away completely. And her husband said, you know, a few months ago she went vegan, you know, no animal products at all, and that has changed her life. She feels so great now. And the doctor said, no. There's no way that a diet causes endometriosis, and there's no way that a diet change is going to cure it. There's only one explanation for this. This has got to be a miracle. So the doctor felt that this had to be a miracle. What I would say is it's probably a hormonal effect of all the cheese that she was eating. But be that as it may, the endometriosis never came back. Her fertility returned. She now has 3 children. She still has her uterus. She is now teaching other women how they can reclaim their own hormone balance and their health too.
That's a great story. I love that. And I just can't get over the disconnect between doctors and not all doctors, many doctors, and nutrition. The other thing I wanted to ask you is how do we replace cheese? Do you have any suggestions on how we can replace cheese? Because last night I went to a 4-course plant-based dinner that probably contained, I probably ended up eating 2 cups of nut cheeses. And I don't think that's healthy either. I mean, I certainly think, you know, a little nut cheese, there's nothing wrong with that. But can you tell our listeners what they should eat instead?
Yeah. Well, when I wrote The Cheese Trap, I worked with Drina Burton, who is a genius in the kitchen. And Drina is great at answering the very question that you asked, which is, what can I eat instead? She came up with all the recipes for everything from, you know, what you put on your salad, what you put on your pizza, how to make a cheesecake with no cheese at all. So let's start with my salad. Instead of feta on the salad, you can use little avocado chunks. They have a nice mouthfeel, very nice subtle flavors, but there's no hormones in it, no cholesterol. There's nothing to apologize to the cow for. If you have pizza, what I really like to do is use nutritional yeast. And if you haven't had this, you go to the health food store, and in the supplement aisle, they sell these cylinder can things of nutritional yeast that have no fat, but they have a very cheesy flavor to them. And you just mix it into a sauce, and it also goes great on vegetables and things like that too. The nut cheeses, they're there, and I consider them sort of cheese methadone. So if you are a cheese addict, the cheese, there are a number of these. They're not all nut cheeses. Tree Line is made from cashews. It's absolutely delicious. Miyoko's Kitchen.
Yes.
It's like a work of art. Yes. But Miyoko herself will tell you, you know, don't just stuff huge amounts of this into your mouth. This is a treat. So this is a nibbling food. Or there's Kite Hill cheese that comes out of the LA area. And Kite Hill is made with a cheese making process, but it's made with almond milk instead of dairy milk. So it tastes like cheese because that's what it is, but it's a non-dairy cheese. So you can have all these, but to me, they're sort of a transition to simpler foods. So if you're an absolute cheese addict, going to the vegan cheeses, it's a good move. There's no cholesterol in them. The fat, the content of the fat, the quality of the fat is better, but the content may still be too high. So I don't think you're going to lose a lot of weight that way. But there's no hormones in them. There's no dairy protein. So for the person with asthma or whatever, they're likely to do better. But as time goes on, what you find is that you end up liking simpler and simpler foods.
I can't wait to try those recipes. Well, most plant-based doctors only focus on the health issues. But you really surprised me in one of your lectures by talking about the ethical issues. And I wanted to know what your thoughts are on that and what people should know without, you know, 100% upsetting them. I mean, I it makes me very emotional, so I know how people feel out there.
Well, there are just a few simple things that when people know it, they can make decisions for themselves. And here are the things to know. And people, I'm sure they understand this, but they might not have thought about it. As I mentioned earlier, no animal makes milk until they've been pregnant and given birth. So a woman doesn't make milk until she's had a baby, and then the milk is for her baby. So the cows are impregnated by the farmers every year. And it's good for people to know how it's done. You take your left arm, you put a glove on the left arm, it goes all the way up to the shoulder, the left hand is inserted into the cow's rectum up past the elbow, and then the farm hand can feel the uterine wall through the rectum. So with the left hand, they hold the rectum, they hold the uterus still. With the right hand, they take what looks like a knitting needle and insert it through the cervix and inject semen that came from a bull. These animals are not volunteers, but they don't have any choice in what is happening to them. And 9 months later, she will give birth to her calf. Whether she wants to or not, this is her baby because she was impregnated. But the calf is now in the hay and looking up at his or her mother. And she looks down at her newborn baby. And the calf blinks his eyes and she tries to lick her calf clean. And the farmer looks at that and says, isn't that beautiful? You know, this is the mother infant bond is here. And it is, but the farmer also knows that if that baby stays with mom, the baby's going to drink the milk and the dairy is going to take that milk. So the farmer has an implement that solves this problem, which is called a wheelbarrow. And the farmer picks up the calf and puts the calf in a wheelbarrow and walks away. Now there is no bond stronger than the bond between a mother and her infant, no matter what species you are. And so the mother will object, and she'll push, and she'll follow, and pretty soon she'll have a gate smashed in her face, and she will stand there crying for her infant that has now been taken away from her. Now, I don't care what species you are, to have your child taken away from you is not something you would choose. And 3 months later, she will be impregnated again, and after 9 months, the same process happens again. Then she's impregnated every year. Then once she's about four, the farmer does the calculations about how much milk am I getting out of you anymore for the unit feed that you require. And the calculations will show that it's about time to kill the mother and replace her with her daughter. And that's what happens, is that the mother is loaded up. She is hung up by her legs and her throat is slit and she will become hamburger. And her daughter and the next generation is hooked up to the milk machines. They are impregnated. They are separated from their children. Their milk is taken, and then they are turned into hamburger. So the dairy industry is a meat industry. But before we turn you into hamburger or other cuts of meat, we're going to impregnate you. We're going to take away your offspring and make you go through that. And you're just going to be, your body is going to be used for the service of milk production. So the reason that for me, the reason I included this in the cheese trap is, although I don't talk about these humane issues in my books typically, but I thought that for people who are wondering, should I get away from this? Once they know these things, the industry seems a little creepier and it makes them want to make some diet changes, and their coronary arteries don't really care why they've changed.
Yeah, it's very upsetting, you know, and I know that for me, that for a long time I never really put that together with what was on my plate. And once I went vegan, I became so much more sensitive to that subject. And it's so hard for me to believe that I ever did, you know, eat.
Well, I have to tell you, you go to some goat cheese farm, and ask if you can be there when they're giving birth. And watch that, and look at the cute little goats, the kids as they're born. And the male goats, you ask the farmer, look the farmer right in the eye and say, what's going to happen to this goat? And he is going to lie to you, probably, and say, well, we can't keep him here. We'll find a good home. They kill them all. What's going to happen to the females? Well, we'll milk them, but if their production slacks off, they're going to kill them too. So don't get the idea that there's somewhere where this doesn't happen. If you're going to have a milk-producing industry, the animals are at your service.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Bernard, for sharing all your knowledge today and for your dedication to helping people live a long and healthy life. I really appreciate you being here. I wanted to ask you one last question, and it's a little personal, but would you mind sharing with everyone what you had for food today?
What did I eat today?
What did you eat today? Like, what's a typical day for you?
That's a nice question. Thank you for asking. Varies a lot from day to day, but this morning I had a big bowl of oatmeal, and I am big on cinnamon, and sometimes I put blueberries or strawberries on it. And lately I have been hooked on papayas and mangoes, and I'll mix. I know this sounds, well, it sounds almost like a dessert, but I can just eat huge amounts of it. Well, I'll take blueberries and mangoes and bananas, and I put them together because the blueberries are a little bit tart sort of, and the bananas kind of melt that out. So I had those together. And then for lunch, it was completely different. I had a bean burrito, which is a tortilla with what I call refried beans inside, but they're really just pureed pinto beans. But I put in just enough jalapenos to make it not quite life-threatening. And for dinner, some friends have invited me out to an Italian restaurant, and I'm probably going to have something like angel hair pasta with a sauce that's made of tomatoes and artichoke hearts. And I know the chef, they put in these wild mushrooms that they saute, and they grill asparagus that they put on the side. So I have to say, the funny thing is, people think of a vegan as sort of restrictive. When I was growing up in Fargo, North Dakota, every day was roast beef, baked potatoes, and corn, except for special occasions when it was roast beef, baked potatoes, and peas. And now on a vegan diet, I eat a much more varied diet, and I would not go back to the roast beef, baked potatoes, and corn if you paid me. So I enjoy the food. I'm not really a foodie, but you know, it's good food.
100% agree. Well, thank you again, Dr. Bernard, and I look forward to seeing you on the Holistic Quality at Sea, I hope, in 2018.
And I'm exciting, you bet.
Yes, and thank you again. Bye-bye.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for today's podcast. I am deeply passionate about changing the way you look at food, and I hope I'm doing a good job. If you have any questions or feedback at all, send me an email at questions@ordinaryvegan.net. Or you can also record a live question or message to me on my website, ordinaryvegan.net. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please give it a rating or comment in iTunes. The more reviews this podcast receives, the more prominently it gets featured on iTunes. And don't forget to join our healthy, vibrant community on Facebook at facebook.com/ordinaryvegan. We are over 311,000 strong, and our community loves to help and support each other. You can find this week's show notes with links to everything we spoke about today at ordinaryvegan.net/Neil Bernard. You can learn more about Dr. Neil Bernard's books and programs at pcrm.org. That is it. We have so many exciting podcasts coming up, so please make sure you subscribe on iTunes so you don't miss a thing. And I look forward to serving you on my next podcast. Till next time.
Thanks for joining our plant-based community today. Together, we can accomplish great things. Please subscribe so you don't miss any of Ordinary Vegan's recipes and plant-based tips. If you have any questions or feedback, email us at questions@ordinaryvegan.net. Until next time.